This is the BBC.
This podcast is supported by advertising outside the UK.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Burrow's furniture is built for the way you live. From ensuring easy assembly and disassembly to honoring highly requested new colors for their award-winning seating, they always have their customers in mind. Their modular seating is made out of durable materials to last and grow with you. And with Burrow, you always get fast, free shipping. Get up to 60% off during Burrow's Memorial Day sale at burrow.com/ACAST. That's burrow.com/ACAST. burrow.com/ACAST.
Thank you for downloading this episode of In Our Time. For more details about In Our Time and for our terms of use, please go to bbc.co.uk/radio4. I hope you enjoy the programme. Hello, here's a quotation from a 12th century source. I neither can nor may I tell all the wounds and all the pains which they inflicted on wretched men in this land. This lasted the 19 winters while Stephen was king, and it grew continually worse and worse. To till the ground was to plough the sea. The earth bare no corn, for the land was all laid waste by such deeds. And they said openly that Christ slept and his saints. That's how the Anglo-Saxon Chronicle describes the period of turmoil and conflict that characterised England from 1135 to 1153, and since been known as the time of anarchy. The Stephen in the Chronicle referred to was Stephen of Blois, King Stephen's, and his nemesis was his own cousin, the Empress Matilda. Their power struggle was undoubtedly long and disruptive, but were the levels of lawlessness and chaos so tremendous as to justify being labelled as the anarchy? And why did it take so many years to resolve their dispute? With me to discuss the Empress Matilda and the anarchy are John Gillingham, Emeritus Professor of History at the London School of Economics and Political Science, Louise Wilkinson, Reader in Medieval History at Canterbury Christchurch University, and David Carpenter, Professor of Medieval History at King's College London. John Gillingham, the Civil War can be traced to the death of Henry I's son William in 1120. Would you give us a brief sketch of the roots of the conflict?
Well, as you say, the death of William, drowned in perhaps the most famous shipping disaster of the 12th century, the wreck of the White Ship, meant that all the ruling king's plans for the succession to the throne after his death went awry.
Everything had to be rethought.
He had the one son, one legitimate son, many illegitimate children, it should be said, more than 20, but only two legitimate children, one son and one daughter. Everyone expected, his father expected, everyone expected William to succeed, but the death, the unexpected death, In this naval catastrophe, put everything up in uncertainty.
But he had a daughter, Matilda.
But he had a daughter, indeed. But in 1120, she was married to the emperor, or the king of Germany,
and the emperor of the Romans.
And he was known as the king of the Romans. Yeah. After he died, that's to say, her husband, King Henry V, the emperor. She was called back to England and to Normandy, because we should remember that her father ruled Normandy as well as England. This, after all, was the Anglo-Norman realm, as many historians call it, put together following the Norman conquest in 1066. And ever since then, the fortunes of this joint great realm of England and Normandy had been fought over by the descendants of William the Conqueror, among whom, of course, in the next generation were Stephen and Matilda, both of them male and female descendants of William the Conqueror.
Henry I gave his daughter Matilda to understand that she would inherit and become the ruler of the Queen after his death. Can you just tell us something about that, please, John?
Well, certainly when he recalled her to his court, he must have given her that understanding. It's clear, though, that this was an uncomfortable prospect for pretty well all the political elites of the time, both in England and on the continent. And in consequence, he not only gave her to understand this, but he forced the great men of England and Normandy to swear an oath that they would accept her as the heir, his heir, in, if he did not have another legitimate male child. As soon as William died, William, his son, died, the first thing he did was to marry again in very, very fast pace. But despite all his best endeavours, his second wife bore no children for him. And so there was Matilda. She expected to rule. But although her father, Henry, made this plain, he actually didn't do anything to implement it. She had no power base within England and Normandy. And if she was to take over as a woman, an uncomfortable prospect, then she really needed a power base within England and Normandy to enable her to do so. And he was so reluctant as he grew older and older in the last few months of his life that he refused to hand over any castles to her and to her husband. And this meant, although he told her she would inherit, he actually messed up her chances of inheriting.
So her cousin, Stephen of Blois, a direct descendant of William the Conqueror, seized the throne, effectively, in 1135. How was that move received by the ruling classes?
Well, in England, so far as we can tell, it seems to have been received with acclamation and relief. In London, in Winchester, in all the centres of power in England, people acquiesced pretty quickly to the, as it were, unexpected turn-up, but welcome turn-up for the book, I think. In Normandy, it was rather different, because the barons in Normandy had expected, actually, Stephen's older brother to be a more likely candidate to take the throne. No one, I think, in Normandy wanted Matilda. She was a woman, after all. But Stephen had an older brother. Plans were afoot to make him Duke of Normandy and then King of England. But as soon as he heard that Stephen had acted with such alacrity, Theobald stepped back, and so Stephen was also recognised in Normandy.
And also Matilda was in Anjou, so she was out of the country, and also the Pope accepted Stephen, which was a big factor at the time, because he didn't accept Matilda at any time. Let's move on to Matilda, Louise Wilkinson. Can you tell us a bit more about her? Several times John has mentioned uncomfortable, and also the word woman, so let's address that for a start.
Well, Matilda's a very, very interesting figure. I think she was, in terms of character, very strong-willed. She was a very proud woman. She was very conscious of her royal birthright and her position as potential heir to the English throne. Contemporary descriptions speak of her really in terms of behaving in an arrogant fashion, a haughty fashion. Those who are perhaps more sympathetic to her admired her masculine courage. Note the term masculine rather than feminine. And also they speak of her being of a noble character. I think really the key to understanding her character in this period comes from looking at her imperial background, at that first marriage to Henry V, King of the Romans.
She was sent to marriage when she was 12.
She actually went to Germany. She was delivered there and received by papal envoys in 1110 when she was just 8 years old. And thereafter she was educated in German customs, the German language, and really the protocols of the imperial court. And there was a long tradition in Germany of very active queen consorts. And almost actually from the moment of her marriage in 1114, at the age of 12, she played a key role in imperial affairs. She sponsored royal grants. She interceded with petitioners.
Can we just get this clear for listeners? Because it's a bit baffling. The 12-year-old is doing things. Is she been doing things because people in charge of her are telling her how to do things? Or is she exercising independent control?
I think it's actually part of her education. I think initially she works closely with her husband and with his advisors. She's actually accompanying him in 1116 on an imperial journey to Italy. And when Henry is recalled from Italy by a rebellion in Germany, it's Matilda who stays in place in Italy, acting as his regent with the help of his ministers. So she's doing that as a teenager, which is very, very striking, actually. So she has this tremendous imperial background, this role in German government, and she expects to be an empress probably at that stage for the rest of her life. So when her husband died in 1125, when she was summoned to return to Normandy, and then, of course, summoned to go to England to be recognised as her father's successor, she had all of this behind her. And I think this explains a lot of her later behaviour. She was a very proud woman.
So, but there was great resistance, as has already been hinted at by John. Can you give us a succinct summary? Of the resistance to her.
Well, there was a great deal of disquiet with the idea that a woman would inherit the English throne. No other woman had inherited a claim to the English throne in the past. And there was a lot of prejudice against the idea of a female heir to the crown in this period. Now, the lines...
Primogeniture didn't apply at that time.
It did apply, but it's inheritance in the direct line. And this created the possibility that when there were no sons, daughters could be heir to lands. The thing was, this had never been applied to the ruling dynasty, to the crown before. The problem, of course, was where you had a female heir, especially a female heir to the crown, was that actually this didn't sit at all comfortably with the status of women in medieval society. They were seen as the heiresses of Eve. They were seen as being irrational, fallible, inferior to men, in need of male governance, guidance and discipline. And so really, questions were asked about whether a woman should inherit the crown herself and reign herself, or whether she should transmit her claim to others, to a male heir.
Sorry. In the Chronicles, we'll come to this at the end, there's a lot of stuff written about all this at the time. She's always referred to as arrogant, overweening, intemperate, and so on. Were these words that would not, if applied to a man, would they have been used in terms of admiration?
I think they would have been used in terms of admiration, absolutely. I think the problems that Matilda encounters later in life are to do with the fact that she behaves in a kingly fashion, an authoritative fashion. As, of course, as a woman, you're meant to be subordinate, inferior, humble, submissive. So she's criticised for her unwomanly behaviour. There's one occasion in a source called the Gesta Stefani, where it describes an encounter between her and the Londoners, and every trace of a woman's gentleness removes from her face, which is extraordinary, really. But yes, there was a lot of gender-based criticism against her.
But she did make some mistakes, perhaps we may say that,
yes,
and we will come back to those later. David Carpenter, the other main personality of the story is Stephen of Blois. Can you tell us something of his background and how he effectively seized the throne in 1135?
Well, I think we can get very, very close to Stephen from wonderful picture of him in contemporary chroniclers. And his strength was that he was a great knight, a valiant knight. He was up for anything, and you can see that in his seizure of the throne. But the other side of his character was that he was affable, easygoing, easily placated, warm-hearted. And there's a wonderful story of how, when he saw a little boy, a hostage, about to be catapulted into a castle in order to execute him, he rushed forward, seized him, rescued him, and took him off to his tent to play the medieval equivalent of conkers.
Is this hagiography or history?
This is real. No, this is contemporary material. Very good sources for all of this. This is what Stephen was like. There's no doubt at all about it. He was, as I've said, easygoing. He saw himself, in a way, almost not as a king, but as a great baron from which he comes. It's very important to remember, of course, he never thought he would be king. And until the very late years of Henry I, you know, this wasn't something. And so he comes out of a baronial elite, and he doesn't see himself as superior to his fellow barons, almost their equal. And that's actually said at the time about him. So no, I don't think this is a later hagiography or anything. This is what he was like, quite different from King John.
That's too much to go into. We're told that he was very good in battle, though.
Yeah.
which seems to be at odds with the softness that.
No, I don't think so at all. You can be, on the one hand, a valiant knight, and you can be decisive in action, and yet, on the other hand, when you're with your fellow friends and barons, you can be very generous, open-hearted, and of course, in a sort of way, that was the mythology of what a king should be. He should be largesse. He should spread it all around. Stephen loved spreading largesse around. The problem was that it was so difficult to choose who ought to have it, and once they've got it, are they going to be loyal? When, of course, if you offend anyone, there's somewhere else to go. You can go to the Empress.
Can you tell? Can you give us a brief rundown of this, and then we'll get on with the story? The state of England in 1135, when Stephen, effortlessly, it seems, from reading what you've written, became king.
Well, I think there were two problems. To be fair to Stephen, it was a very, very difficult situation to inherit. And there was burning resentment, I think, in England about two things. One was that Henry I had constructed a very powerful governmental system. The Exchequer, which we still have today, was Henry I's invention. And it records everybody's debts in a very intrusive way. All the great barons owe money to the king, and it's being exacted from them by the Exchequer. There are also a lot of
They didn't like that, did they? How things stay the same.
Absolutely the same as today. Also, he had a lot of new men, as they were called, men raised from the dust who ran this system for him. And the old baronial elite just couldn't stand these people poking their noses into their affairs. And then the final problem, which was so difficult, was that since the Norman Conquest, there'd been a huge turnover in land holding and in office. And rival families felt, I should have that land, I should have that office, I should have that castle. And so throughout the counties of England, there are these family history disputes. And of course, poor Stephen, who hasn't really got much judgment, has to choose between these rival groups. He has to give patronage to one. If he does, he offends another. And if he does that, of course, you create a disgruntled group who got somewhere else to go.
So we're talking about a lot of mighty barons, not unlike the early Dark Ages, about 600 years before, and they're rampaging across the place.
Well, lots of people wouldn't like you to say that. They would think that these are rational, calculating magnates who are concerned with local rule and law and order. You know, we mustn't think of them as a sort of
mindless... Well, why mustn't we? I mean, you've just described that.
But they were rational, calculating people 600 years earlier as well.
Yes, they were. I mean, the King of Mercia, the King of, and the King of Northumbria, well, the ruler of Northumbria and Wessex, the dreadful bunch.
And Stephen's affability was surely one of his great strengths. It meant that he could talk to all manner of people in a way that didn't make them feel condescended to. In consequence, they rather liked him. This meant the Londoners, the citizens of Lincoln, the citizens of York. It wasn't just the great aristocrats who Stephen got on well with. And above all, perhaps, his likeableness meant that his wife was... He really got on incredibly well with his wife, and she was to be an enormous support to him. Whereas the Empress Matilda, for all her strengths of character, clearly did not get on very well with her husband, and that was to be a great source of weakness.
You're shaking your head about this.
No, I'm actually sort of saying, no, she didn't get on well with her husband, because actually she married Geoffrey of Anjou, the son of the Count of Anjou.
He was 14 and she was 25
yes,
at the time. She was unfortunate in the age difference in terms of marriage.
She was. And also she had her imperial background. She might well have felt that she was being disparaged in being married off to the son of a count. And actually the marriage didn't work initially in personal terms at all. Within a year of the marriage, in 1129, the couple had fallen out seriously, and Matilda had actually returned to her father's court, and a reconciliation wasn't actually effected until 1131. And then thereafter, things do seem to have got better between the couple. They improved dramatically.
Well, they had three children, which is some evidence.
Yeah, she produced regularly sons obligingly for her husband.
Let's get back to the line that I'm trying to follow. John, for all his affability and chivalric nature, Stephen had no problem at all about elbowing the Empress Matilda, did he? Well, let's leave that to one side. But her fortunes changed when one of Stephen's most powerful allies, Robert of Gloucester, switched sides. Why was that important, John Gillingham?
Well, it is undoubtedly a decisive moment for Matilda, for the Empress. It creates the opportunity for her that she had really missed in the first year or two after her father's death. But I wouldn't describe Robert of Gloucester, the man you're talking about, the half-brother of Matilda, one of Henry I's many illegitimate children, but a young man who had been brought up at Henry I's court, promoted high in to the great landholdings in England and Normandy. I would never describe him as Stephen's ally. In a sense, they're clearly rivals already at the time of King Henry I. And
but in the right beginning, he was on... I use the word ally, but not all that loosely, John, because in the beginning, he was on Matilda's side and not on Stephen's side. He was on Stephen's side and not on Matilda's side. He allied with Stephen of Arth.
If he formally allied, he did so with great reluctance, clearly, because
he still did it.
Initially, he preferred Theobald, not...
Yeah, but Theobald was out of the count. I mean, he didn't want to... So Stephen
once,
cut across Theobald.
Bond is right on this, John.
Oh,
he's right on everything.
Please, that gets me into terrible trouble.
Stephen was so successful in the first 12 months of his taking over the throne that Robert of Gloucester clearly calculated that to do anything other than go with the tide would have been politically absolutely hopeless. But... This distrust between Stephen and Robert of Gloucester right from the beginning of the reign, indeed right from before then, and they both are eyeing each other with suspicion. And as soon as it becomes politically feasible to go into open opposition against Stephen, which is in 1138, Robert of Gloucester does so.
But the terrific thing, really, for the Empress Matilda is that he gives her what her father didn't give her. He gives her, he allows her access to a stake in the kingdom, the great holdings in the West Country that Robert had and also in Kent. So she comes back, she lands in Sussex in 1139 with something to hold on to, an ally, a close ally, and all this base. And that changes the game.
No. I mean, Robert clearly was perhaps quietly an ally of his half-sister right from the beginning, and an open ally once he defies Stephen in 1138. And then the two of them come over from the continent, as you say, and land on the Sussex coast at Arundel in 1139. Robert then rides off to Bristol, which is a very powerful city and fortress, the centre of his possessions, as it had been for many, many years, leaving his sister Matilda behind in Arundel.
And that's one of the strangest moments, isn't it, Louise Wilkins? Because there she is, she's arrived, she's a threat. And this is where being a woman might play for her, you tell me. Because had she been a man, he could have incarcerated her there or somewhere for the rest of her life,
yes.
And nobody would have said, they'd have said, that's the thing to do.
Yeah.
But according to what I've read, he is chivalric, and he says, this is a woman, I must have her escorted to the place she's destined, intended to go to, so he gets her escorted to Bristol. What about that?
Well, it's interesting. I mean, first of all, it's just worth pointing out that it was no accident that she landed at Arundel, or she landed in Sussex and headed to Arundel Castle, because that was actually the castle that was held by her stepmother, whom we've heard about previously, Adelicia of Louvain. Adelicia, after Henry I's death, had actually remarried William Daubeny. And so Matilda seems to have been fairly certain she would receive a warm welcome from her stepmother when she landed. Robert, of course, departed soon afterwards to go and rally forces in the West Country. And then Matilda remained there temporarily under her stepmother's protection. And it's quite interesting, really, what seems to have happened next. Stephen, who was preoccupied, really, with trying to lay siege to Corfe at that time, which had been captured, actually, by some of Matilda's sympathisers, Baldwin de Redvers, then headed straight over to Arundel Castle and laid siege to it. And then, of course, he was faced with this problem that you've mentioned, what to do with Matilda. On the one hand, her half-brother was rallying troops against the king's cause in the West and becoming a significant danger. But on the other, he had this woman, a kinswoman, who was potentially a captive of his. So what did he decide to do? If he arrested Matilda and incarcerated her, that actually might make a big slur on his reputation. It might damage his reputation significantly. It also undermined the protection that was being offered to Matilda by Adelicia of Louvain. So we're told that Henry, Bishop of Winchester, actually persuaded Stephen that a more prudent sort of course of action would be for him to allow Matilda to join her brother in the West. So we get this sense of chivalric behaviour perhaps on Stephen's part coming through, perhaps in the hope that Matilda would actually go and unite with Robert, and then they could go against Robert and Matilda together in one fell swoop in the open field.
David Carpenter.
I just think this is nonsense, really. And this is a classic example of Stephen's pathetic quality of judgment and of this sort of weakness and easygoing affability. It was crazy. He should have incarcerated the Empress. Mm. And the idea that once they were all together in Bristol, it would be easier to get rid to deal with them was, I mean, it was just complete reverse of the case. Kings need sometimes to be roaring lions, and Stephen just couldn't be that. Henry I would have imprisoned them straight away, and that would be the end of it all.
John Gillingham.
As usual, David, speaking with emphasis, but I'm not sure that you're quite right about this, because, as you say, what would King Henry I have done? We know that at the beginning of his reign, he had fought against his older brother, captured him in battle and kept him imprisoned until the end of his life.
Exactly.
But his brother, Robert, had a young son, an innocent, in political terms, who had done nothing wrong. And even the ruthless King Henry I did not dare keep a child in prison. And that was to be, if you like, in your terms, a massive political mistake, which was to cause King Henry I endless trouble for the next 20 years. Now, if the tough old King Henry I couldn't treat innocent people like this, then Stephen didn't make a mistake, I think. It worked out badly for him, but it wasn't an obvious political mistake.
No, I think that all along, Stephen, he should have executed the garrison in Exeter Castle when he took them. He should have shown the ruthless face of kingship from the start, and then nothing like this would have happened.
There's a disagreement across the table, ladies and gentlemen. I wouldn't mind cracking on, but do you want to disagree a bit, Louise, and then we can...
I'd just like to say that actually it was a highly controversial decision from the point of view of contemporaries as well. Some saw the advice that Henry offered Stephen as deceitful advice, and while others saw it as outstanding counsel. So there was a lot of contemporary concern with Stephen's actions at the time.
The anarchy, so called, we'll come back later to whether it can be properly called the anarchy. It was a 19th century appellation by the historian Stubbs, but the anarchy lasted for nearly 20 years, but there were hardly any pitched battles at all. The most significant one was at the Battle of Lincoln in 1141, and in which... can you tell us about that, David?
Yeah, the background here was that Ranulph Earl of Chester, who was sort of wavering ambiguously between the two sides, seized at the end of 1140 Lincoln Castle, to which he'd got a family claim. And it was through a wonderful trick of his wife, who he sent into the castle to have afternoon tea, then went in to sort of bring her home and managed to take the castle as a result. A wonderful glimpse of a countess in action too. So Ranulph Earl of Chester has got hold of Lincoln Castle. Stephen marches up to Lincoln to expel him, does expel him, but then Ranulph allies with precisely the person you've mentioned, Robert Earl of Gloucester. The two of them bring a large army to Lincoln, and Stephen is simply defeated. He fights valiantly to the last. He's then captured, and that clears the way for the Empress, it seems, to become Queen.
Yes. Now, we have to get a bit of a move on here, otherwise we're going to shortchange. The Trades Descriptions Act is calling in here. So, Louise, we come to the other Matilda. Do you mind if I just say a little so that we can get... She was from Boulogne. She was very rich. She turns out to be the heroine of the story, according to the Chronicle. She raised armies. She raised armies in this case. This is to go and try to get her husband rescued, and she attacked various cities with these armies, but she did it in a womanly fashion. I don't mean that to be ironic. That's what the Chronicle said. So she played a big part in securing his release. And one of these... And eventually Robert of Gloucester was captured. So can you take the story on from there, okay, which gave her leverage?
Well, basically, Matilda of Boulogne wages a tremendously successful campaign during the course of 1141, during her husband's captivity, against the forces of the Empress. She managed to bring about the surrender of London to her forces and bring about the expulsion of the Empress from London on the eve of her coronation. She then basically proceeded to do a lot of bridge building with people who defected from her cause in the interim, so she managed to bring Henry, Bishop of Winchester, back to her husband's side. She then actually went to assist Henry when he was besieged by the Empress's forces in Winchester, besieging the besiegers. And it was during that rout that, of course, Robert of Gloucester was captured. And this was really a godsend for Matilda of Boulogne, because it gave her a very powerful bargaining counter to help bring about her husband's release from the forces of the Empress. And this was actually effected later in the year. In November, there was an exchange effectively of prisoners. So Matilda of Boulogne secured her husband's release. Robert of Gloucester went back to his sister. And it's really rather lovely, because at Christmas, when Stephen was released, Matilda actually wore her crown alongside her husband at the great Christmas court in Canterbury. Mm. She was a tremendously capable figure, a woman of subtlety and a man's resolution, according to the author of the Gesta Stefani.
So we have the exchange of prisoners, and inside that, John, we have the notion that had Matilda, Empress Matilda, acted more ruthlessly, then she could have made terms after the capture of Stephen, which she, according to Chronicles, was too arrogant to make these terms.
Whatever, she acted less ruthlessly, I think.
Less ruthlessly. Sorry, terms. I got it wrong. Yes, absolutely right, yeah. If she had been conciliatory rather than, yes.
Yes, it's very noticeable that, I mean, there are endless negotiations going on between the sides, and that the Empress is usually kept back from the front line of negotiations, whereas Stephen's wife is usually in the foreground of diplomatic discussion. I mean, she's clearly the woman who knew how to persuade people. The Empress knew how to get people's back up.
At this time, David Campner, we have a country where David of Scotland is surging into the north of England. Cumberland, Westmoreland, Northumberland are falling to him. He's buried, as we know, at Carlisle. The Welsh are in turbulence. The West Country is in the hands of somebody else. Where the Midlands, the great lords, are controlling the Midlands. It has been called the anarchy, although much later. How much do you think that word applies, the anarchy?
Yeah, I personally do think it does apply, although with limitations of time and place. I mean, King David in the north, Stephen in the East Anglia, the Empress in the west, there were periods when they were able to maintain peace and stability. But at the points where the forces collided, I think they were very, very terrible times, especially for the peasantry. And if you look at the contemporary chroniclers, which are the real source for our understanding of the anarchy, or there's a lot of other material that backs it up, I think there are two key things here. The first was the gigantic spread of castles, 40 new castles built, and the castellans, the men in charge
40,
of those,
40,
yeah, 40 new castles, many old ones were rebuilt as well, and the castellans, the men in charge of these castles, terrorised the local population, both to get supplies but also to get garrisons. So that was one form of anarchy. The other form of the anarchy is that the whole nature of warfare in this period was that of ravage. You ravage the estates of your opponents, which you could do so easily by burning the crops in the field, burning the villages, which were all wood. And you did that not simply for fun, but to destroy the economic basis of your opponent. So I think if at times you'd sort of stood on top of the Wiltshire Marlborough Downs and looked down at the plain between Swindon to Oxford, you'd often see villages burning and, you know, peasantry starving to death. So I don't think anarchy is at all wrong for this period.
John Gillingham, would you agree with that?
I agree about if you look down from the Berkshire Downs, but there clearly were war zones within Britain, and if you lived there, then you were in trouble. You could expect trouble next year, you could expect trouble. But for large parts of the country, it was much like any other period. You were essentially under the rule of the local baron or the local gentleman, the local castle holder.
It was pretty rough if you lived in the north of England. You had the Scots coming down and ravage you in every 10
years. If you lived north of the Tees, the years up to 1138... were disastrous, because King David led these Scottish armies down pretty well every time he could, and they ravaged and brutalised and slaved in a way that English contemporaries found to be atrocious. On the other hand, you began with a quotation from the Peterborough Chronicler about the 19 long years. What, of course, he didn't go on to quote, which no one does go on to quote, is what he then says immediately afterwards, when he says that, and in that time, our Abbot Martin built new vineyards, improved the church, he acquired lots more estates for the abbey. So the thing is that passage was written at the beginning of Henry II's reign. The whole ethos of Henry II's reign was, they were bad times before, I am bringing back the good old days. Everything that went before under the old regime was rubbish. Nothing but mistakes, pathetic rule, now a brave new dawn. And one mustn't accept, as it were, the propaganda of the new government.
It's not propaganda. I think it's a real estimate of the situation. I think one key
especially
thing to remember,
the new building at Peterborough, you mean?
Well, no, as I've said, there were pockets when that was. I think one key thing to remember is that the great men of this period are brought up for war. They love war. And, I mean, there are wonderful anecdotes of Waller of Moulins, who just sacked Tewkesbury. And what does he say? He says, never in England or in Normandy before have I achieved such a burning. You know, they love doing it. Or there's Robert Fitzhubert. And what does he say? In Normandy, I burnt to death 40 monks in a church, and I'm going to do the same in England. And he covers his victims before hanging them outside Devizes Castle in honey, so bees should sort of feed on them and everything. And these were ruthless, violent men, and they loved it.
Yes, it's a constant strain through English literature that the nobles are saying, but England loves a war. The men want to go to war, isn't it?
I mean, these are the colourful stories, of course.
Sorry, pardon?
These are the colourful stories told with verve, as we've just heard. And it's not surprising, they're the memorable bits. History is what you remember, as Sulla Ernie Aitman said. And David's absolutely right about one thing there, and that is that the barons and the nobles were brought up to be prepared to go to war, and some of them clearly liked it. This was one of the Empress's great disadvantages, the expectations of a ruler in the early 12th century. We can see it in all manner of chronicles and sources, is that they ought to be able to lead their men into successful war, and that was not likely to be true of a woman, though Stephen's wife showed that it isn't. There isn't a perfect generalisation on this point.
She was... Louise, can I ask you to take us from the stalemate being broken in 1147 when Matilda turned her attention not to her own ambitions but to that of her son Henry, who was then 14, which was a significant age, it seems, at that time, old enough to get cracking, really, and make a bid for the throne and that sort of thing, and how that drove through to him becoming... to the Treaty of Winchester in 1153, when he and Stephen agreed that he would be Stephen's successor, and a year later he was. I'm sorry it's a big ask, but could you do that?
Yes, indeed. Well, it's interesting because in 1147, of course, Matilda's great ally, Robert of Gloucester, died, and she seems to have come to a sort of growing realisation that perhaps the future for her lay in Normandy, so that she could hand over her claim to the throne more fully to her son, Henry of Anjou. And so Henry becomes increasingly recognised in this period as Matilda's lawful heir. And when Matilda returns to Normandy in 1148, she retires to Rouen and plays an important role there, actually, as regent of Normandy subsequently. She no longer describes herself in her charters as Lady of the English. Henry himself in this period is really built up as Matilda's successor. He famously, of course, is knighted in 1149 at Carlisle by David, King of Scots, who, of course, is Matilda's uncle. He isn't, though, at that point really able to lead a successful campaign against Stephen. But what happens is he returns to the continent, and during the succeeding years, he actually builds up a tremendous collection of territories on the continent and a great reputation as a military leader. So his father, for example, hands over control of the Duchy of Normandy, which Geoffrey's conquered in 1144, to his son. His father dies, and Henry then assumes control of his father's lands, so the great lands of Anjou. And then after that, Henry really excels himself, and he secures the hand in marriage of Eleanor of Aquitaine, the divorced wife of the King of France. And, of course, she's this great heiress to the southern lands of Aquitaine. And so he builds up this great collection of lands on the continent, holdings that are greater in France than those held by the King of France. And this, I think, makes him become a viable contender for the English throne, especially his control of Normandy. Because we have to remember in this period that a lot of the great barons, a lot of the great earls, held estates in both places. And so he was able, finally, in 1153, to launch a campaign to attempt to conquer England. Once he arrived in England, though, the situation is quite interesting, isn't it?
We'll have to move a bit faster than that, I'm afraid. The fact is, at the Treaty of Winchester, he makes a deal with Stephen, King Stephen, saying he will be the successor.
There seems to have been a genuine desire for peace in England when he arrives in 1153. But this leads on to the Treaty of Winchester.
The death, of course, of Stephen's eldest son, Eustace, and that was absolutely crucial because Eustace was determined to get the throne, whereas Stephen's second son, William, was perfectly happy to go back and be a great baron again. And so that was what it made the Treaty of Winchester possible.
I entirely agree with David. The death of Eustace...
You waited this long.
Absolutely, absolutely central, because Eustace was married to the King of France's sister, and the King of France, Louis, was not at all happy by the fact that his ex-wife had married Henry of Anjou to be Henry II. So had Eustace lived, it was quite possible that there would have been a very powerful alliance between the King of France, King Stephen, and the heir, Eustace, the heir to the throne. And Henry might have lost, but Eustace died.
You wanted to say something, Louise.
And also, we should also remember that Matilda of Boulogne died in 1152, and she'd really championed Eustace as Stephen's successor. So that, I imagine, must have removed a degree of pressure from Stephen, perhaps, as well.
John Ingenham, when Henry became King of England in 1154, which is a year after this treaty, what sort of kingdom did he inherit, and how did he go about putting it in his own image?
Well, I think the most important thing is that he inherited a kingdom which was thoroughly fed up with war and the uncertainty and insecurity that the succession dispute had engendered. So his position was so strong that when King Stephen died, he didn't have to rush to Winchester or to London to get the throne. He could take his time. Everyone knew, everyone desperately wanted a secure succession. Once he was on the throne, that meant that they still felt like that, and he could start to sort of throw his weight around a bit, and people acquiesced in it, because the one thing they were not prepared to risk again was to go into the kind of situation they'd had for the last 20 years. So Henry was very fortunate. He was also proved that because everyone knew he was going to succeed, everyone sucked up to him. Everyone said what a wonderful person he was and what an awful king Stephen had been.
As he had been.
And so what do you think with Henry inherited David Carpenter?
I think he did actually have a more difficult situation than John's just sketched, in that there had been a catastrophic decline in royal revenue. Absolutely catastrophic. I mean, Henry I had been very, very rich, and his income had been about £24,000 a year. When Henry II succeeded, I mean, the income was just a few thousand pounds a year, which is a measure of the utter collapse of the power of English kingship. So he has a very difficult job in rebuilding royal revenue, royal authority. Although I agree with John, I think that there was a desperate desire to have peace and order after, quotes, the anarchy of Stephen's reign.
Lucky Henry had Aquitaine and Anjou and Normandy as well. So yeah, the greatest dominions ever ruled by any king of England up to that time.
That mattered.
That certainly mattered.
Louise Wilkinson, finally, you've been talking very easily from sources, and there seem to be a great number of useful, happy sources for this particular event. Can you summarise them? I'm just being told we've got very, very briefly. I'm sorry about all this.
Well, we have a tremendous number of sources for Stephen's reign. We have more than 30 national and local chronicles that survived that give us good information about what was going on in this period. In addition to this, we have fabulous government records. For 1155 to 1156, we actually have the royal accounts for that year, the financial accounts of the king's income, the wonderful pipe rolls, which allow us a sort of an insight into the restoration of royal government under Henry II. We also have a wealth of charters, and more than 100 of which actually record evidence of destruction caused by warfare.
Well, thank you very much, and thank you for going through such a lot so well and speedily. I feel a bit embarrassed about pushing all that. Never mind, I hope people got a lot out of it. I certainly did. Thank you to Louise Wilkinson, John Gillingham and David Carpenter. Next week, we'll be talking about the ancient Indian philosophical text, the Upanishads. Thanks for listening.
There are many more Radio 4 arts and discussion programmes to download for free. Find these on the website at bbc.co.uk/Radio 4.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Full of merriment, mischief, and mistaken identity, enjoy this audiobook collection of 8 of Shakespeare's most magical comedies, starring David Tennant, Helena Bonham Carter, and Miriam Margolyes.
Nobody marks you.
What, my dear Lady Disdain? Are you yet living?
Start listening to BBC Radio Shakespeare, a collection of 8 comedies, available to purchase wherever you get your audiobooks.